yay, oh yay, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060714, Barbara Robinson individually and as representative of the estate of John Robinson, deceased, versus Crown Cork and Seal Company, Inc., individually and as successor to Mundet Cork Corporation. Docket number 060867, Pine Oak Builders, Inc., versus Great American Lloyds Insurance Company from Harris County in the 14th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 070639, Don's Building Supplies, Inc. versus One Beacon Insurance Company as assignee of Botanic Insurance Company of Illinois. And that's a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and we should complete all arguments before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. A link to all three arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060714, Robert Robinson versus Crown Cork and Seal.
And please the court, Ms. Hankinson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case is straightforward and simple. And this is because the answer to the constitutional challenges presented are grounded in two indisputable things. First, the plain language of the Texas Constitution, Article 1, Section 16 and 29, and second, over a century of law from this court consistently interpreting that language.
Is there a police power exception to this retroactive clause?
No, there is not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because Section 29 of Article 1 of the Texas Constitution says that there is no exception for anything contained in the Bill of Rights, and the retroactivity clause is contained in the Bill of Rights. And this court has consistently held, and I believe we've cited at least six or seven opinions from this court acknowledging that fact in our brief.
How does the Barshop versus Medina County case apply to
that's
this?
Correct. Barshop has language to the contrary, but Barshop is not controlling, and Barshop can be explained. First, Barshop did not involve a retroactivity challenge based on the vested right that obtains to an accrued cause of action. It involved the Edwards Aquifer Act, and looking backward at the retroactive effect of the law, that is, the permitting process under the conservation clause of the Constitution that the legislature was invoking, allowed past usage to be used to determine whether and how permits would be issued in the future. And so the court determined that having that kind of retroactive effect did not make a law retroactive. Now, in the context of that discussion, the court made a statement about the police power being available to override the retroactivity clause. There is no mention in that opinion of Section 29 of Article 1 of the Constitution. Don't know why it's not there, whether it was not briefed, the court overlooked it, I'm not quite sure. But the point is that that provision remains in the Constitution, and both before and after Bastrop, in cases that specifically involve a retroactivity challenge, including ones involving accrued causes of action, the court has invoked Section 29. And every time you find Section 29 mentioned in a Supreme Court opinion in connection with the police power and the Bill of Rights, you find that this court has said that the police power is an exception, is accepted from the rights that the people have reserved to themselves in the Bill of Rights.
Is there any difference in this statute and the statute that was decided by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 2004, I believe?
There are a couple of differences, for example, with respect to the date that is used in it for purposes of the corporate transactions. But at the end of the day, it is the same statute, and it's the same statute that Crown has now gone to several other states to get. And so at the end of the day, while the Pennsylvania Constitution, under its open courts provision, has a remedies clause that invokes the retroactivity concept and the concept of vested rights, at the end of the day, the result is the same.
And that's still the only foreign court to tackle this issue so far, Pennsylvania.
With respect to?
The issue we're facing today.
I'm sorry?
The issue we're facing today, the Pennsylvania decision from 2004, is still the only one out there.
Yes, Your Honor, we checked before coming today for argument, and that's the only one that we see on the books. Of course, the last two statutes that Crown has passed in different states, they've made prospective only. But there are still several other retroactive statutes on the book. But Pennsylvania, which is the home state for this corporation, its Supreme Court has said that it is unconstitutional because it retroactively deprives the plaintiffs of their constitutional right to an accrued cause of action, which is a vested right. So the analysis is the same at the end of the day, and the technical differences in the statute, for example, with respect to the date, make no difference.
Now, there's some comment that this is a special law created only for Crown. Is that important?
It is a second basis on which the statute is unconstitutional.
Does it matter if other corporations benefit from this law?
It does matter with respect to the first element of the analysis under the special law provision of the Texas Constitution. Every time this court has looked at a challenge under the special or local law provision of the Texas Constitution and has determined that the classification is not open-ended, that is, that no one else falls within the category or the classification used in the law, the court has determined that it's a special law. On this record, this is not an open-ended provision. It is not. And it is tied to a date back in the 1960s. So it can't be open-ended. The events that trigger this particular immunity under the law date back to the 1960s. So we know whether anyone is within that or not, because you can't have a transaction now and bring yourself within it if the original transaction hasn't already occurred.
Why would someone have a vested right to a remedy against an innocent corporation?
Your Honor, that's spin. Innocent corporation, an innocent successor, as used in this particular law, is spin. If you look at the law on successor liability and what happens when corporate transactions occur, the common law, which this court recognized in 1880, said that when certain corporate transactions take place, the liabilities have to go someplace. And you can do one of two things, and variations of the two things. You can do an asset purchase, in which one corporation purchases the assets of another, and the liabilities remain with the first corporation. If you do a merger or a consolidation, when we have both in this case, ultimately a merger, then the two corporations come together and become one, and the liabilities are there with the surviving corporation. Typically, what you have is you have an exchange of stock by the part of the shareholders. They give up their stock in the old corporation for in the new corporation, and as a result of that, you have continuity of ownership. The law does not countenance the idea that corporations can engage in transactions in order to jettison their liabilities. The liabilities lie someplace, depending on the kind of transaction. Here we have a merger. First of all, we had a stock purchase. Then Crown sold off the insulation assets but kept the old liabilities.
You say Crown sold them off. I thought Mundat sold them off.
The papers, Your Honor, which are in the record, indicate that Crown owned 80% of Mundet at the time this happened, and that when the assets were sold, It was sold by Mundet, a division of Crown Cork and Seal. And that's what the New York transaction documents reflect on the bill of sale. So apparently at that point in time, Crown was controlling it, and it kept the liabilities. So the bottom line is this whole idea of no settled expectation, because this is an innocent successor, is spin.
Well, let's talk
Crown
about,
is Mundet.
Let's talk about settled expectations. Where do we draw the line? It seems like the Court of Appeals struggled with the difference between a mere expectation and a vested right. Some courts holding a mere expectation is not a cause of action. It has to be a final judgment. Where do we draw the line there?
But not this court. This court has never said that. In 1849, this court first held that an accrued cause of action is a vested right. And ever since that De Cordova case in 1849, this court has consistently held, through Mellinger in 1887, Middleton in 1916, City of Tyler versus Likes in 1997, Baker Hughes in 1999, this court has never said that a judgment is what is necessary for there to be a vested right. If you look at the language from De Cordova that this court then cited again in Mellinger and has over and over again cited, the language is that the legislature cannot extinguish or eliminate an accrued cause of action either by adjusting the statute of limitations or by creating a new immunity or defense. It cannot do that without giving a reasonable opportunity to the holder of the vested right to preserve that right. This statute is a total elimination. There was no reasonable opportunity given for Mr. and Mrs. Robinson to be able to preserve their right. So, Your Honor, the answer to your question is that the Texas Constitution has a retroactivity clause that prescribes a prohibition against retroactive loss. This court, beginning in 1849, and the language has never changed since then, has said that there is a settled expectation on an accrued cause of action because the events giving rise to the cause of action have already occurred. That's what accrual means, and that's why it's a settled expectation. And Justice Heck said the same thing with respect to the accrual of a defense. I'm sorry,
Your Honor. You're saying that the court can't look at the legislature's belief that there's an emergency, there's a crisis situation or an emergency in order to do what we at least suggested we could do in Barshop and say the legislature in its exercise of police powers can.
That's exactly right. And if you look back, Your Honor, at De Cordova and Mellinger, that was exactly the lengthy discussion that this court had, that there is no such thing as an emergency that the legislature can rely upon in order to override something in the Bill of Rights. There's a whole discussion about emergencies and why that can't be the case, because then the police power swallows the Bill of Rights. If you create an exception under the police power, you trample on the specific language of the Texas Constitution. My suggestion to the court is that the language in Barshop is stray language that does not fit with the other 150 years of jurisprudence in this court, and the fact that it did not cite Section 29 can only mean that the state of the record before the court, it was not picked up.
Well, as with many constitutional rights, the issue might be a bit more nuanced and not perhaps not quite as straightforward as you see it. In terms of the right, assume it's a vested right. Why is it not appropriate to look at this as a matter of restricting to some degree the remedy, not taking the right away? Because the statute just limits liability. It doesn't say you don't have no claim at all. And it's also pointed out that there's been recovery by your clients against other parties and other defendants in the case. Sounds like you're saying that the right has to be against this particular defendant, not
correct.
Not the right to have a recovery for the injury suffered against some culpable parties?
First of all, Your Honor, I disagree with you that this is nuanced in any way. Braden, in his discussion of the Texas Constitution at page 62, points out that what is a vested right under the Texas Constitution is a diverse, presents diverse questions depending on the circumstances. And if you're going to answer the question, you have to look at the line of cases that deal with your specific situation. So we're dealing here with a crude cause of action. And, Your Honor, there is nothing nuanced about the multiple opinions from this court about an accrued cause of action being a vested right that's protected under the Constitution. Second of all, it extinguishes the cause of action, the accrued cause of action here. And dating back again to De Cordova, and then in Mellinger and everything in the 20th century that this court decided, the court has said that you cannot extinguish a cause of action without providing a reasonable opportunity to preserve the right or, if the remedy is affected, to substitute a remedy. Now, the argument that Crown makes that you are referring to with respect to multiple defendants does not hold water. And here's why. Because we learn in first-year law school that a cause of action accrues against a particular defendant. This court in Flores just said that defendants are not fungible, that you have to prove your case against a particular defendant. And as a result of that, this court has said that separate causes of action can be severed into separate lawsuits. You don't have one cause of action against multiple defendants if you have multiple tortfeasors contributing to the injury. You have a separate cause of action as a matter of law. That's why you could sever this particular case, for example, and only have Crown here and not the other defendants. If it were one cause of action, you couldn't do that.
There are lengthy legislative findings, of course, that precede the body of the statute. And
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
There are lengthy legislative findings, of course.
There are not in this case.
Let me ask you a question then. And the Chief talked about lawmakers finding an emergency situation that sort of compelled them to pass the statute. And, of course, you say Section 29, very forceful, very categorical, hard to get around Section 29. But putting that aside for a moment, how do we normally treat legislative statements of emergency and findings that this really does create a compelling situation and needs urgent action?
First of all, we don't have any legislative findings here. I can find no history on the Crown statute in which the legislature ever held hearings, in which it ever studied the issue and made legislative findings like you would find in the Edwards Aquifer Act or in Article 4590I or under the most recent law in 2005 dealing with asbestos claims, where there are lengthy findings. What you have here is the statement of one legislator who made his statement part of the record. And this court has consistently held, most recently in 2006 in the AT&T case, that the statements of a single legislator are not legislative history. And then on top of it, the record in this summary judgment case contradicts what he said on the record. This was to save hard-pressed successors from bankruptcy. That's not Crown. And this statute only applies to Crown. So that proves the point that the court has been very careful about not looking at the statements of a particular legislator with respect to ascertaining that. So we don't have, Your Honor, the kind of findings that you're referring
looking
to.
Looking quickly to Section 16, all the clauses there have a federal constitutional counterpart.
No, they
except,
do not. Except.
Except for retroactive law.
Right.
Some people say, well, maybe it's just a civil sort of counterpart to ex post facto. Is there any sort of research you've dug up or unearthed that describe the history behind the adoption of that provision?
The earliest discussion of it is the De Cordova case, Your Honor. Back looking at that provision, then Mellinger goes into a very lengthy discussion as well. And what's very, very clear, I think, from the discussions in those two opinions is that the people meant what they said. They deliberately put in the Bill of Rights a protection to themselves from retroactive laws enacted by the legislature, allowing no exception for emergencies or the exercise of police power or anything. That makes the Texas Constitution different from the federal Constitution. And why this case should be decided on this court's precedent and not on anything else.
Thank you, Ms. Hankinson. Are there further questions? The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
Please the court. Mr. Phillips and Ms. Stewart will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Cruz will present argument for the Attorney General. Mr. Phillips will open with the first 15 minutes.
Mr. Phillips, what's the public interest or emergency that the Texas legislature was trying to protect the citizens of Texas against in passing this retroactive law?
Your Honor, this was one piece of the asbestos crisis, which has been perhaps the greatest challenge to the civil justice system in the history of America. Hundreds of thousands of suits clogging the court. 75 companies approximately have gone bankrupt. All the major target manufacturers are in bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy trusts are paying 2.5 to 5 cents on the dollar in claims. Suits have proliferated to secondary and tertiary type defendants.
What interest does the Texas legislature have in protecting foreign corporations?
Well, this is a foreign corporation that has 1,000 employees and 1,000 retirees in Texas. Affects property taxes, the local economy. This company cannot sell itself because one of the things Ms. Hankinson said is that this class was a static class. Everything had happened back in the 1960s and nothing can change. It can change. If Coca-Cola decided it wanted to buy its own bottling cap entity, it couldn't look at Crown Cork right now as a corporate successor to Mundet. It would buy into hundreds of millions of dollars of asbestos suits. So this corporate structure could have been done several ways. If the seller had been willing, it could have been an asset sale, in which case no liabilities. It could have been bought. Crown could have bought Mundet and kept it as a separate subdivision of the company, kept it as a wholly owned subsidiary. Then the liability that Crown would have incurred would have been capped at the total value of that subsidiary. And so what this bill did is it looked at the fact that in the 1960s, when these transactions were taking place, there was no 402A yet. There was no knowledge that asbestos was going to turn into a crisis. So it limited the exposure of someone who bought a company before anybody knew about all these problems at the total amount they paid for the company.
Could the legislature do that in all areas? Can they just eliminate successor corporate liability under this innocent corporation theory?
Well, successor liability is now a statutory matter. Generally, each state regulates the corporations in its state.
But for tomorrow, you know, corporations buy each other all the time. Can they just say from this point forward, retroactively, we're going to say that a plaintiff that has an accrued cause of action against the successor corporation no longer has that claim. We're going to eliminate it.
It's not our case,
yeah.
And it may create some due process issues. But this is a pretty narrow, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, this is a very narrowly tailored statute to take care of a national problem starting with one step.
Does it include anybody other than Crown Corp?
Well, we know that Exxon has claimed it.
It could include
other people because new people are still being sued in asbestos as people run out of money. And as I mentioned earlier, if anybody wanted to buy Crown, they would inherit these lawsuits if this statute were not in place.
But even if you assume that the statute has laudatory purposes and that it was enacted, that it's not facially unconstitutional, couldn't it have just been enacted to apply prospectively rather than retrospectively?
It could, and there I think it's important to look at the Owens-Corning decision of this court. If it applied only prospectively, it would defeat the intent, the purpose of the statute, because there are 20,000 pending cases against Crown Cork in Texas.
But we don't know that in this case. I haven't looked at the record, but I haven't seen any evidence cited that these particular cases that were already in the pipeline would cause the company to go bankrupt. And the Court of Appeals opinion specifically refers to negative impact on Crown Cork's financial vigor. Now, I didn't see any evidence that, but for wiping out these lawsuits, the company was going to go under, which is the purported reason for the statute.
Well, I don't know that the Supreme Court of Texas has to find that the company would be bankrupted but for this statute.
But
we do know that before these statutes started being passed around the nation, Crown stock went from $60 to less than a dollar.
But I guess my question is, if we're talking about the police power and the public good, does it have to be to actually save a company that will die otherwise, or is it just negative impact on financial vigor? What sort of public interest is there to protect the financial vigor as opposed to viability?
Well, I think this is a balance. And I think that's the way the court treated this in several recent cases, starting with Texas Water Commission versus Wright in 1971, and then in Barshop. You look at the rights that are impacted versus the public good.
Let me ask you about Barshop.
The more severe the impact, I think the higher the good has to be.
But quickly on Barshop, a dozen years ago, unanimous opinion, authored by a fine jurist, that nowhere mentions Article 1, Section 29.
Well, I think that Article 1, Section 29 is virtually a total red herring. What that says is that everything in the Bill of Rights, and indeed everything in the rest of this document, the rest of the Constitution, is accepted out of the general powers of the state. That only means that the Constitution is superior to a statute, which this court and the legislature had a little trouble with in the 1860s and 70s, so it needed to be said. But it does not enshrine a Hugo Black view of constitutional interpretation. We balance rights all the time. Bouillon and Dietz both used Article 1, Section 29 to say that the Bill of Rights did not give an individual a private right of action against another individual. It operated only against the state. And the only case I'm aware of in the entire jurisprudence of this court that used Article 1, Section 29 to limit the rights of the legislature to, or a court to balance constitutional rights, was the Travelers Insurance versus Marshall, Chief Justice Curtin's opinion in 1934, which essentially has been dead letter since the United States Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Brandeis in the Henderson case, interpreted that same provision 2 years
later. And what does it mean? I mean, looking at the words on paper, what does Section 29 mean?
It means that the Constitution is more important than a statute. That a statute can't violate the Constitution. But on any clause, whether it's free speech, due process, you apply the normal rules of constitutional interpretation, of interpreting broad language, that you would anywhere else. In fact, looking at the jurisprudence, if petitioner were to prevail in this case, it would truly be a landmark opinion, because on the retroactivity challenge, in the entire history of this court, since 1836, the court has never struck down a law as violating either retrospective clause, that was the Republic's language, or retroactive clause, except for cases involving a statute of limitations that had run, and a change in the statute of limitations would revive that cause of action. And the court most recently did that in Baker Hughes versus Kecko. They've done it several times before. But despite all the language and a lot of dicta and a lot of general statements of the law about if it's a vested action, it can't be taken away, the only holdings, the only time the clause has actually been applied is in that statute of limitations situation. And on special laws, Article 3, Section 56, the last time the court struck down a special law, not a local law, not geographical law, but a special law, was either 1942 or 1950, depending on how you count the Rodriguez case. So this is truly a startling proposition based on the court's jurisprudence.
Isn't corporate successor liability just part of the inherent risk of mergers and acquisitions? I mean, we don't limit the amount of money a company can make after an acquisition or after a merger. How can a legislature limit its liability?
Well, since this is a statutory matter, the legislature can change the statute. And if they have a reasonable need for that, it survives due process. In my opinion, if balancing any harm caused to a claimant against the public good the public good outweighs, they can make that statutory change.
Do we look at
here,
one particular claimant, or do we look at all the citizens of Texas that have been exposed to asbestos and perhaps could have a claim? How is that balance made?
This is an as-applied challenge. I think you have to look, at least in large part, at Mrs. Robinson and the Robinson family. I think in drawing this balance, you also have to look at the state as a whole. And the cases aren't entirely consistent on this, but it seems to me there's four factors that have been looked at in making a balance, which is increasingly what the court's going to do before they are ever going to actually strike a law down as violating the retroactivity clause. It seems to me first you look at the expectations of the involved parties at the time the events were taking place. So you look at Mr. Robinson in the Navy Yard, not realizing there was any problem, but if he did, his expectations are he would have a suit against this manufacturer, Mundet, whose assets for all their divisions, which included crowning as well as insulation, included asbestos and non-asbestos divisions, was $7 million. So that's his expectation.
You're sharing your time with co-counsel, is that correct?
I am, and as I counted, I have four more minutes.
Okay.
Then secondly, you look at, of course, if you look at Crown Court, as I've already mentioned, they had no knowledge that buying a company that had one division that made some asbestos insulation products that was already out of business by the time this merger was affected, that would lead them to hundreds of millions of dollars at the time of this statute, $413 million in liability. Then you look at change in reliance. And here's where I think you have to look at these individuals in an as-applied challenge. How did Mrs. Robinson change her behavior in reliance on the state of the law as it was? And the answer from the record is not at all. There were suits brought against 21 different entities. So a claim remains against 20. Some of those people were dismissed, some have settled, some have gone away. But there was no saying, well, our discovery shows really there's just one defendant, we're going to cut everybody else loose because we know we can hit this defendant because they've been bought out by a larger company. There's no change in reliance at all. So that's the balance on not allowing this statute, on striking it down. On the other side, you have two factors that we've already discussed. One is, what is the public interest in not having transactions from 40 years ago bankrupt important business entity within the state? And the other is, as we saw in Owens Corning, what would happen if we change it from retroactive to prospective only? And would that defeat the purposes of the statute? And Owens Corning really seems to me is the closest case to this one. There, people have been streaming in from all over America and suing in Texas for claims for in asbestos suits, and they were able either to use the statute of limitations in Texas or the statute of limitations in their home state. And the legislature stopped that, and it stopped it retroactively and said, essentially, you were bound by whichever limitations period was shorter. And the practical effect of that was that a number of Alabama plaintiffs who filed suit between January 1 and May 29th of 1997 and were already in Texas court were out of court and could no longer proceed in Texas and no longer had a suit in Alabama. And that was not just against one of 21 defendants. They were out against all defendants. Their claim was over. And this court looked at whether or not that presented a retroactivity problem. And one of the things the court looked at in reaching the answer, no, it did not, was that if you only applied the statute prospectively, it would defeat the very purposes of unclogging the courts, of having Texas courts open for the remedies that Texas citizens needed to pursue. And so the court upheld that statute.
And what is the proof in this case to support that latter finding?
The fact that we know that there are about 20,000 claims in at least 1,000 different lawsuits against Mundet in Texas.
But from what I understand, there's no evidence in the record that they would have threatened the financial existence of Crown Cork.
Well, I'm not sure, again, that financial existence is the necessary test. But if you look at the past history that Crown was in within a dozen years or so after these lawsuits started, if you look at the late 1990s around the turn of the century, their stock was almost worthless. Their debt was immense, and they were not able to borrow anymore. And these statutes in the states where most of the suits were pending, and Texas is, of course, the biggest state for asbestos claims against them and most other defendants, have been instrumental in turning the company's economics around to some extent.
So just to nail this down really quickly, going back to 29, when the people of Texas say everything in this Bill of Rights is accepted out of the general powers of government and shall forever remain inviolate, that is nothing more than just the statement of a legal truism that statutes are subordinate to the Constitution.
Yes, and if you look at opinions from the 1860s and 70s, they needed that because there were challenges to constitutional provisions on the grounds that they violated a statute. So this was taking Texans back to first principles. If there are no more questions, I will return the balance of my time to Ms. Stewart, who will speak primarily on the special laws, but also as trial counsel, she can answer more details about the progress of this case.
Why shouldn't this be construed as a special law that certainly appears to be protecting only one single foreign corporation?
Respectfully, Judge Medita, that's not the test. And the petitioner would point to you that may be because Crown is the only one here today that this is a special law, but this court in its line of cases has held that the test for a special law is not whether it may now apply or whether only one defendant or one party may be before you, but whether there's a reasonable basis for the law and it applies equally on all within the class. Every case that this court has decided, and there have been cases that have upheld classes of one, for example, August Bush, the case out of Texarkana, and Julep Gardens, there was a class of only one. But as long as the classifications are reasonable, then the court should uphold it as not a special law. And the petitioner told you that this was not an open-ended class, and that is simply not true. First of all, there's a cap where a corporation is liable only up to the fair market value of the company at the time they merge, but that is scaled to present-day value. We do not know, and it's petitioner's burden to prove a statute unconstitutional, and it's a heavy burden. And the petitioner's not come forth with any company that the statute may not now apply to. But as time goes on and the time value of money changes, they may be at the cap with a corporation with whom they've merged. There may be future successors, and my co-counsel gave you the example. If Coca-Cola were to decide that it wanted to have within itself a canning operation, would it merge with Crown Cork and Seal? Probably not. It would go find another company. Also, there are new defendants being added to asbestos litigation all of the time. You know, there are CLEs out there talking about new defendants. How do you defend yourself in asbestos litigation? There's been several articles in the national media talking about toaster defendants becoming involved in asbestos litigation. So the class of asbestos defendants, which is what this statute was designed to protect, is ever expanding. And so this is simply not an open-ended classification. And even if this class were not open-ended at this point, the court would still go look to whether there was a reasonable basis for the law and whether it operated equally on the class. Well, what was the reasonable basis? The reasonable basis is separating out culpable defendants, culpable successors, from innocent successors. And the legislature made a determination that when should a corporation have known that it would be submerged in this liability? And they picked the date of May 13th, 1968. So if we look at the history of asbestos litigation and what knowledge was in asbestos litigation at the time, that's a reasonable date by which to conclude that a successor should have known of the risk. And Justice Medina, you raised the question, shouldn't the merger in and of itself, the nature of a merger, alert a company that there are risks? Yes, it should, but not prior to that date. What company would have known that this could possibly happen by that date? So what the legislature...
Some perhaps very good plaintiff's lawyers would argue that this knowledge was out there in the 30s, way before 1968 when Dr. Sulikoff published his papers. So, I mean, how do you come up with that date? That seems to be... as good a date as any, but others would argue that the knowledge was out there 30s and 40s when studies were done by Canadians and other industrial hygienists?
You're exactly correct, Your Honor. And the answer to that question is there are many dates out there. In fact, there's a recent case out of the 14th Court of Appeals called Altimore that was just decided, I believe, in the summer of 2007, where they go into about 5 pages of discussion on what knowledge was out there about asbestos and the dangers of asbestos in the field of knowledge. This is a heavily litigated point in every asbestos trial.
Presuming the validity or the good intentions behind the statute, mm-hmm. let's presume it has a good purpose but where does it lose that purpose by making it prospective only rather than retroactive?
Your Honor, I see I only have 7 seconds left, but I'd like to answer your question. The answer to that question lies in everything out there about asbestos litigation that this court knows and the record before this case. In this state alone, Crown had 20,000 pending cases against it. This court
was directed at that particular 20,000 case docket?
No, Your Honor. I think what this statute is directed as is the problem that this court has addressed. In Owens Corning versus Malone, this court recognized that asbestos litigation in the state of Texas was a disaster and that the legislature should address it, but this court could not. In Ortiz versus FiberCorp, the United States Supreme Court.
My point is, if it were unconstitutional to the extent it was retroactive,
yes, Your Honor.
It would still serve the effect it was intended to serve.
Respectfully, Your Honor, it would not. And I think my co-counsel's analogy to Owens Corning is an example of that. The asbestos problem has long been recognized by the courts of this state, by the courts of the other 49 states, and by the United States Supreme Court as a pending problem. And the financial difficulties of the corporations that are involved in asbestos litigation have always seen it as a pending problem. For this reason is why the major players are all gone.
Is it your intention that we hear from the state?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I think your time has expired, the state's time, but the court has asked to hear from the state. So, Mr. Cruz, would you make your presentation?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. There are two relatively straightforward ways to uphold the statute at issue here, either under Barshop balancing or concluding that the statute is a statutory remedial provision. But there's a more important provision which I'd like to focus my argument, which is the scope of vested rights. The state would submit that all causes of action are contingent. There has been language and dicta in past cases that has been difficult to follow, and indeed the Court of Appeals in this case threw up its hands at trying to follow what that dicta meant. But what we would argue is that by its very nature, an accrued cause of action is an expectancy, a hope of ultimately prevailing.
But haven't we said the opposite?
With respect, Your Honor, the Court never has clearly said the opposite. What the Court has said clearly is in Ex parte Abel, the Court said, a vested right, quote, is something more than such a mere expectation. It must have become a title, legal or equitable. That's the clearest thing this Court has ever said on it. Now, there is language in Mellinger and Middleton that can be read to the contrary, but the language in both of those cases is contradictory. And in fact, what I would point this Court to is De Cordova. Ms. Hankinson relied on De Cordova as her central case to look at, and I'd point the Court in particular to the paragraph that begins at star 6, where the Court explains the statute of limitations may be changed if it is soon to run, but once it is run, it can't be changed. That paragraph, I would submit, explains the basic dichotomy. The day before a statute of limitations is about to run, the defendant is in the same position as a plaintiff is with an accrued cause of action. They have a claim under current law. In a day, they're going to be out. The law changes. De Cordova says, tough luck. It may have been 2 years. Now it's 5. If your statute hasn't run, if the contingency hasn't become an actuality.
Isn't the premise, then, that you have an opportunity before the statute to get some sort of relief? Here there's no substitution. It's a complete extinguishment of the cause of action.
With respect, the opportunity to correct is relevant only if there's a vested right to begin with. If it is a mere expectancy, if there is no right, then there needn't be an opportunity to correct. If I had slipped and fallen walking into this courtroom, I would not have a property right in the potential to sue the state under the Tort Claims Act.
But if you did sue, and, I mean, let's say there was a waiver, let's say it's common law, and you got summary judgment on your claim, could the legislature then come in and say, no more recovery for slip and falls?
In our judgment, yes, up until a final non-reviewable waiver.
And where do you point to other U.S. Supreme Court decisions or other states that have that holding?
Among the federal courts of appeals, the federal courts of appeals are divided 7-3 on this question, with the majority agreeing with what we submit, that an accrued cause of action is not a vested right. And the state intends to submit a short supplemental letter laying out that breakdown just to provide those authorities to the court. The seven follow the Hammond case, which we cite in our brief. The Hammond case, which clearly states that rights in tort do not vest until there is a final non-reviewable judgment.
Is there a distinction between this statute and the statute that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court interpreted in 2004?
The statutes are functionally identical. The Pennsylvania court was applying a different provision of its constitution, and Pennsylvania law is clear that a cause of action is a vested right. Texas law is at best conflicting, and in our judgment, the better argument is that it's not a vested right. You have ex parte able, you have a series of court of appeals decisions we've cited.
It seems to me if it's not a vested right, the next legislative session will be very interesting. People coming in droves to eliminate causes of action. Isn't it? I mean, that's not a concern that the court ought to have.
Mr. Chief Justice, respectfully, that is a judgment for the legislature to make. Justice Stevens, writing for the U.S. Supreme Court in Landsgraf, talked about that retroactive positions often serve entirely benign and legitimate purposes.
It is for the legislature, but we have to decide what does vested right mean as a matter of law, and then the legislature does with it what it will do.
The alternative construction, which various opinions have assumed but never held, means that every plaintiff has a property right, an entitlement, in a possibility of whomever they might sue at any given moment. And this court has repeatedly said that no litigant has a vested right in a statute or rule that affects remedy. That's enable. Article 1, Section 16 does not forbid laws which merely affect the remedy. This court has repeatedly said that you don't have an entitlement for the law to remain. Even Mellinger and Middleton, the two strongest cases with the broad language, Mellinger is explicit that a state of facts must exist that entitle a plaintiff to recover in court. You're not entitled to recover until you have a final judgment. You have a hope of recovery.
Let me ask you very quickly.
One final question.
In terms of the vested right analysis, if there is a vested right, if there clearly is, then you'd agree that under the Constitution the police power couldn't override it.
We would not agree with that. Barshop is quite clear, and a whole series of decisions of this court are quite clear, that in applying the retroactivity provision, this court balances, and this court balances the judgment that the legislature made. Much as Justice Stevens says, once the legislature is explicit and says we want this to apply retroactively, and you had a series of questions asking about this particular provision, here the legislature was quite clear. It intended this to apply retroactively, which means the only way not to do so is to conclude that that is unconstitutional. And this court has over and over again, as Mr. Phillips observed, this court has never struck down an action as retroactive in the face of an assertion of legislative authority to do so. And so that's inherent in how the court
has
applied.
And what of Barshop's failure to discuss or even cite Section 29?
Section 29, respectfully, has I would submit, no impact on this case. What Section 29 says, it's very similar to the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. What it says is the legislature doesn't have the power to do anything that violates the Bill of Rights. Well, that is true, and it is also a truism, but it begs the question, what violates the Bill of Rights? I would agree. The legislature lacks the power to pass an unconstitutionally retroactive law. But this court has made clear, in assessing what's unconstitutionally retroactive, one assesses and balances, much like Barshop did, the police power that is being asserted. So if it is unconstitutionally retroactive, then Section 29 says the legislature doesn't have the power to do it. But to answer that question, you have to look to the balance.
Any further questions?
Did Section 17 take away, eliminate a remedy or a right, in your view?
In our judgment, it eliminated a remedy, and so that is, a straightforward ground to resolve this case is to conclude that there was a statutory remedy, which was a suit not against Mundt. The tortfeasor was Mundt. But through a statutory remedy, the plaintiff is allowed to sue another plaintiff, Crown, through, as a statutory mechanism, is now made equally liable. And so the court has said over and over again that eliminating a remedy raises no retroactivity concern.
There was successor liability under the common law, too, though.
Well, Ms. Hankinson asserted that, but has not relied on cases saying that. And regardless of whether there was or not, I would refer this court to the Rose versus Doctors Hospital cases and all of the wrongful death cases, where the analogy is really quite strong. In those cases, in Rose, for example, Rex Rose had passed away. In this case, Mundt is no more, and yet there was a statutory mechanism to sue, to provide a lawsuit, even though Rex Rose wasn't there anymore. The analogy is the same here, and this court had no difficulty concluding that that remedy could be altered by the legislature without raising any retroactivity concerns.
The court will hear rebuttal, and Ms. Hankinson, you'll have additional time if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I fundamentally disagree with Mr. Phillips and the Solicitor General on the state of Texas law. An accrued cause of action is a vested right in Texas. And I'd like to point out two cases to the court. One, they have discussed the Owens Corning case, and let me read you what it says. Considerations of fair notice, reasonable reliance, and settled expectations play a prominent role when a state legislature shortens an existing statute of limitation for causes of action arising in that state, or when it creates an immunity where none existed before, thereby disrupting settled expectations and extinguishing accrued causes of action. That's the policy that underpins all of this court's decisions in which it has recognized that an accrued cause of action is a vested right. The Solicitor General would ask you to change Texas law when the people have not changed the language of the Constitution.
I'm having a little trouble following you, Ms. Hankinson, when you say that the legislature eliminated a cause of action. The cause of action seems to still be there. The remedy is limited to the fair market value of the company that was purchased. I guess under the facts of this case, you're saying because that amount has already been paid out, in this case, your client has no remedy.
That's correct.
Why is that the same, though, as saying the cause of action has been eliminated?
It's the same difference. If you have a cause of action without a remedy, what this court has said is that the court can...
With statutes of limitations. The concept there is the claim still exists, but the statute's run and you just can't recover on it. The reasoning there is pretty clear in lots of cases. You're saying this is different, though.
This is City of Tyler versus Likes. This is exactly what this is. In City of Tyler versus Likes, the plaintiff had a cause of action that had accrued as a result of flood damage. The state came in and created a new immunity that applied to the City of Tyler, which gave it a defense to the claim, a new immunity, a new affirmative defense. And here's what this court said in City of Tyler versus Likes. Like a statute of limitations, a statute defining a municipality's sovereign immunity affects a plaintiff's remedy. The legislature can affect a remedy by providing a shorter limitations period for an accrued cause of action without violating the retroactivity provision of the Constitution if it affords a reasonable time or fair opportunity to preserve a claimant's rights under the former law, or if the amendment does not bar all remedy. That case is directly on point with this case. That is the one where this court said a new immunity that bars the remedy violates the retroactivity provision. In that particular case, there was not a bar because a reasonable opportunity to pursue the claim existed. So there was no constitutional violation. Similarly, the court came along in Baker Hughes versus Kecko and said the same thing with respect to an accrued defense limitations. When the right to the defense arose, The legislature could not come in and take that away. It applies to defendants.
Bankruptcy statutes do that.
But that's a different issue, Your Honor, looking at, I mean, it gets them.
Well, in a way, this is like a bankruptcy statute. This says when the merged corporation, when you've spent everything the merged corporation was worth, we're going to consider that part of your liability bankrupt. No question bankruptcy statute could wipe out a vested right.
That's true, Your Honor.
And so.
But that's the question of federal supremacy and different issues. It's not a question of the Texas legislature.
Well, it's dealing with the Texas Bill of Rights. Because the Constitution says bankruptcy laws have to be federal. But if it didn't do that, if states could have bankruptcy, isn't this in effect like a state?
And that the federal law is supreme. So, I mean, we have those issues. That takes us to a whole different ballgame. Let me just say this. The Fifth Circuit gets it. Twice in the last 2 years, this court, the Fifth Circuit has looked at this court's jurisprudence on accrued causes of action, being vested rights, dealing with the Texas statute of repose, and has held exactly what we've told you we believe the law is. That's the BNSF versus Poole case at 419 Fed 3rd 355 and a Rule 47.5 decision, Vaughn versus Fetters at 2007 Westlaw 1598732. So the federal courts read your jurisprudence and they get it. They get it.
What do you make of opposing counsel's construction of Article 1, Section 29?
I don't understand it, Your Honor. I really don't. Because the Constitution is clear, and when they say this court has never held, we cited to you at pages 15 and 16 of our brief with parentheticals in bold every time this court has said, quote, here's Bollweevil, the legislature has broad discretion to legislate under its police power, and we must uphold such legislation as long as it is justified by a rational legislative purpose and does not violate a specific constitutional provision. Deets, the Bill of Rights serves as a shield against the powers and laws of government. Bullion, the Bill of Rights is a limit on state power. Marshall, that Article 1, Section 29, quote, is an express limitation on police power, which does not appear in the federal Constitution. Spahn, the police power is subject to the limitations imposed by the Constitution upon every power of government. Houston and T.C. Railway Co., if this were true, it says, refusing to accept the mere fact that the ordinance was enacted pursuant to police power is sufficient to ensure its constitutionality because, quote, if this were true, it would always be within legislative power to disregard the constitutional provisions giving protection to the individual. And then we cited several courts of appeals decisions applying that. It means what it says. As the San Antonio Court of Appeals said back in the 1930s, if it doesn't mean that, you've written it out of the Constitution. And this court's view of interpreting the Texas Constitution is to give meaning to the plain language of the Constitution. There is no debate about that. Let me mention about the state of the record with respect to the other defendants. This is not a toaster case. A Cork is not a toaster defendant. They're a core insulation product defendant. Mr. Robinson worked in the Navy. He dealt with insulation products on boilers and on the ships. The other defendants manufactured gaskets. They take the position that their chrysotile asbestos could not have caused his mesothelioma. And in fact, the amphibole that was in the insulation product is what caused it. Two defendants requested a sole proximate cause instruction to try to pin it on Crown. The only expert testimony in the record shows that. That's why, Justice Wainwright, we don't have one cause of action against multiple defendants, and why this court in Flores said that each defendant has to make their own case.
What is your response to the state's argument that the federal courts are divided on whether an accrued action is a vested right?
First of all, that's irrelevant because that's not interpreting the Texas Constitution, and it presents a different issue. And if the court were to decide to weigh in and use the federal court's analysis, first of all, you have a different constitution. You don't have a provision like the retroactivity provision in the federal constitution. And second of all, you would have to decide to overrule your jurisprudence of over 150 years when the people have not changed the language of the Constitution.
But you don't disagree that they're divided and go the other way?
I do not disagree, Your Honor, that the state of the law with respect to the federal courts, which are answering a different question than this court did because the Constitution is different, are split but go a different way.
And Justice Frost's dissent.
Very well written, Your Honor.
She seems to analyze it. All we need to do is look at the Texas Constitution and review that language, and analysis stops there.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Why would it be anything else? This is a claim to a constitutional challenge under the Texas Constitution. She got it right. She did an excellent job in analyzing this court's jurisprudence. Looking at other kinds of things like they would have you do, take it outside the analysis. There is an unbroken line of authority that this narrow question is answered by, and relying on the Texas Constitution. And finally, let me just mention on the special law. I think they prove the point when they say, well, if Coca-Cola bought Crown, we'd still only be dealing with Crown and Mundet. That's the whole point. The first transaction has to have occurred back in the 60s. What this record shows is that Crown's expert did an exhaustive review and could not find any other corporation that met the kind of specific corporate transaction pre the date in the late 1960s that the statute incorporates. It proves the point that this is a closed class. Your Honor, this case falls squarely within the core policy reasons that underpin Article 1, Section 16. I worried when I saw the amicus briefs come in. When you see a case like this and powerful special interests and corporations start piling on and you represent an individual, the individual doesn't have people to file amicus briefs because individual citizens don't have the resources to do that. And then it dawned on me, I don't need any other amicus brief but the Texas Constitution, because the people have already spoken to this court through the Constitution. You have already interpreted the plain language that they gave you. And so they ask you to uphold this, and Mrs. Robinson asks you to find this an unconstitutional law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hankinson. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.